Al Capp, creator of Lil Abner and Lil Abner's friends, the Schmooze, faces John Crosby and Dr. Frederick Wortham on The Author Meets the Critics. First, meet the man who keeps the peace on these programs, your regular chairman, John K.M. McCaffrey.
Good afternoon, everyone. The mayor of the city of New York has, with due solemnity, designated next Saturday, October 16th, as Sweetest Day, a revolting thought, and a day on which all New Yorkers are asked to remember to make someone happy. The Citizens Committee of Sweetest Day has nominated Al Capp's latest cartoon creation, the Schmoo, the sweetest creature of the year, because, and now I'm quoting directly from a letter to Mr. Capp from Mr. Percy Magnus, chairman of the Sweetest Day Committee, because of the happiness and peace which the Schmoo propagates and the aid he will be in restoring humanity's faith in mankind. When Al Capp learned of this great honor bestowed on the Schmoo, he asked The Author Meets the Critics to join in the spirit of Sweetest Day, in short, that we remember to make him happy. And nothing Al Capp thought would give him greater satisfaction and happiness than to defend the Schmoo on The Author Meets the Critics. So here he is, the creator of Lil Abner, the daddy of the Schmoo, Mr. Al Capp.
Thank you, Dick Tracy fan.
Well, now, Mr. Capp, tell me, I am still a little confused about the Schmoo. I've looked at it, I've read about it, but what is it?
Well, I'm confused about the Schmoo, too. I mean, I did it, but there have been
some... I thought, on looking at some of those pictures, that you were a little confused.
There is a resemblance, but I drew it and sent it along through the story of my comic strip, and to me it seemed a simple, lovable little thing that laid eggs and gave grade A milk, and just before I came on this show, it did a remarkable thing. It created a cheesecake, a whole cheesecake, which was quite a strain on the little creature. But at any rate, since the Schmoo has come along, there have been all sorts of interpretations placed on it. And I'm here to learn, what is the Schmoo?
Oh, I see. Well, could you tell us what the Schmoo looks like, Mr. Capp?
Yes, it's soft and pulpy and cuddlesome and it has bright little eyes that make excellent collar buttons.
Oh,
collar buttons make excellent collar buttons. Its whiskers make the finest type of toothpicks. Fried, the Schmoo makes wonderful chicken. Broiled, it makes excellent steak. sawed lengthwise, it can build much better houses than wood can build. There is no waste about the Schmoo. There are no bones, and then one of the night they procreate almost instantly. I hope instantly is a word I can use on the air. they're so eager to please that if you look at them hungrily, they drop dead out of sheer ecstasy. And that's a Schmoo, and now that I've explained it, will someone explain it back to me?
Well, now, Mr. Capp, we have a man who probably would like you to drop dead, but not necessarily through ecstasy. He is the distinguished psychiatrist, director of the Lafargue Clinic, and author of a recent controversial article in the Reader's Digest entitled, The Comics, Very Funny, Dr. Frederick Wortham.
Mr. McCaffrey, I have every faith in Author Meets the Critic. But the Schmoo problem should be referred to the United Nations. They would discuss the Schmoo and the Marshall Plan. United States delegation would make a report. We had the first Schmoo. The British delegation would point out that they're not dependent on American Schmoos and talk about how to hunt Schmoos in Africa. The Dutch would translate the English report, adding Indonesia. And the French delegation would file a prepared statement on the Schmoo's love life. Seriously speaking, when art, and Mr. Capp is an artist, has such an enormous distribution, it has an obligation. There are two kinds of escape, a pure fantasy escape and a constructive escape. The Schmoo offers a solution of human problems on the same spurious level as Nietzsche's Superman or the Superman of the comic books. It is a super animal. It says that if people have all they need, they would want more anyhow. that our wishes can be fulfilled without our doing anything about it. Nobody has to stand up for anything. Nobody has to stand up against anything. That is not a good train of thought.
I wonder if it was completely deliberate, Dr. Wortham, that you left out the Russian reaction in the United Nations to the Shmoo, or have they just vetoed the Shmoo? Probably that's the way it worked out. Well, at any rate, on the other side of the fence with a quite different point of view is the distinguished radio critic of the New York Herald Tribune, Mr. John Crosby.
I disagree violently, as I'm expected to, with Dr. Wortham. I always considered Al Capp a genius, and I've told him so to his face. I'm not one to go around behind people's back with a statement like that. He's a great satirist. He's just as good, and I think a great deal more effective than Swift or Voltaire, because he's, I think, probably more widespread than anything now. I think King features claims about 4 billion circulation out of the 2 billion people in America. Now, in fact, Little Abner and Gulliver's Travels have one great thing in common. They're both satires, but they're both so entertainingly done that people who miss the satiric intent, which Mr. Capp denies, and I doubt him very much, by a block and a half can still enjoy them. Gulliver's Travels means one thing to children and an entirely different thing to adults. And so does Little Abner. In fact, you can find almost anything you want to find in Little Abner. Capp possesses a superb antic imagination which appeals in separate ways to all classes of intellect. In fact, I think it appeals to practically all, everybody except Dr. Wortham. You may be unique, Dr. Wortham. I don't know what exactly Capp had in mind in his parable, The Shmooze. He says it's susceptible to a number of interpretations. This is my thought. I thought it was atomic energy. As a matter of fact, he had a pun in there about the schmoozomic... what was that?
Schmoodatomic.
Schmoodatomic age.
I'm sorry about that.
I mean, atomic energy could be used to make all of us relatively as carefree as dog pats during their brief experience with the schmooze. I think Mr. Capp was expressing the fear that the atom would become subservient to the special interest rather than to humanity at large. If you recall, one character once said in that strip, schmooze are popular with millions of folk, but one customer vars their pest. Therefore, they have to be exterminated, and I believe they were, weren't they? At least they were being exterminated. Also, there happens to be a presidential election campaign underway, and the schmooze were timed rather nicely to coincide with that. J. Roaringham Fatback, who was the villain of Mr. Capp's conceit, is a character of the most virulent right-wing elements of the Republican Party, the element of special privilege. And I suspect Mr. Capp was doing a little campaigning, not necessarily against all Republicans, but against their worst instincts. Fatback at one point said, and I quote, "If these things aren't exterminated, I'll have to change my way of life, and I hate change," which certainly sums up one political viewpoint. Now, whether or not you agree with Mr. Capp's point of view, you must admit that he's taken one of the most depraved cultural media of all time, the comic strip, and by sheer cussedness pushed it to the highest level it's ever likely to achieve. Any man of ideas can starve in a garret writing political pamphlets, but Capp has succeeded in spreading his liberal, and a good many people think he's a radical, into every village and hamlet, and he got rich in the process. I say that takes genius.
All right, Dr. Wortham, what do you think of this accolade?
Well, I first want to say that I don't wish Mr. Capp would drop dead, and I don't have any personal feelings against him. As a matter of fact, I come here, I especially made a poem in honor of Al Capp. It's an ode to a schmoo, and I hope it won't take too long. If it does, you can interrupt me, Mr. McCaffrey. It goes like this. If you have nothing else to do, you might as well look at a schmoo.
Well, that of course, is probably just the first ode to a schmoo, and we can depend, perhaps, for Mr. Crosby, on a long epic on the schmoo, and perhaps some biographical material with footnotes on schmoo and the whole schmoozian literature. Well, you feel, however, Dr. Wortham, to look at the schmoo with a little seriousness, that Mr. Capp shirks his responsibility as an artist with a big, wide audience. And Mr. Crosby's point is quite different than that he does have responsibility, that he is a true liberal, and that he is doing a little campaigning for his liberal ideas. You evidently didn't find such ideas.
No, I don't find that. Let me give you one point right off. Now, I don't like ice being used as suspender buttons. I don't like that. That reminds me too much of Ilse Koch. Now, don't you think so, Mr. McCaffrey?
Why in what way?
Why should one use eyes of animals as suspender buttons? Isn't that a rather
Well, except the Shmoo likes it. Anything that's good, that if you need suspender buttons, the Shmoo says, well, goodness. But Dr. Wertham needs suspender buttons. I'd be only too glad.
That's very serious, Mr. McCarthy, because everybody, apparently, somebody very high up in the world thinks that the victims of Ilse Koch liked it, too. But they didn't.
Yeah, but what has that got to do with Little Abner, Dr. Wertham? After all, a comic strip is supposed to be funny, and I think about the only one that is funny is... Little Abner, the only one that even attempts to be funny. There may be some others. There are a few others. Mr. Cap has a freewheeling imagination, which he uses to make us laugh, and I think he puts ideas in there. He I don't know what your circulation really is, Al, but as an enormously popular figure, I think you are using, comic strip, certainly better than Superman. It isn't entirely escapism. It was never intended to be a really serious medium of information, and if it can be made any more serious and still reach that tremendous audience that Mr. Cap has achieved, I don't see how it can be done. I think that's a fine thing.
Well, I take it your idea of success is that if you make a lot of money or you have an enormous circulation.
I don't think that's
correct. Well, you did say that.
Well, now, I mean, there are comic strip artists that have much larger circulation than Mr. Cap by pandering to, I think, to the lowest instincts. Now, I agree with you on Superman. I think Superman's the greatest moron that has come along in years.
Well, don't you think this is a super animal?
Well, yeah,
I think this will make this one thing that I haven't yet revealed about Schmooze, and you will give me this, that I am the authority.
I won't.
Well, I'm beginning to wonder. But anyway, I think Dr. Wertham will like Schmooze a lot better when I tell them that no Schmoo has ever been known to read a comic book. Also, now, about the eyes being used for suspender buttons, it is true that their eyes are used for suspender buttons. This is something that we can't do anything about. And I don't know... I don't know whether Dr. Wertham objects to this on the grounds of cruelty to Schmooze, but the Schmoo likes it. The Schmoo has eyes only for suspender buttons.
I have eyes only for suspender buttons instead of you. I agree with Dr.
Wertham. Well, there are people who have eyes only
compare the Schmoo to other animals. For instance, the cow. The cow... is an animal who very unwillingly gives sections of himself for dishes that I'm sure Dr. Wertham enjoys. The Schmoo, unlike the cow, is perfectly happy to give his very all.
Well, Mr. Cap, there was an interpretation of the Schmoo in Time. Did you read that?
Yes, I did. I was
maybe we
very
can discuss that a little bit.
I beg your pardon?
Maybe we could discuss that. You see,
I feel that
it is an essential right of every American, is life, time, and the pursuit of fortune.
Yeah.
So let's discuss time, maybe.
Well, I'm perfectly willing to discuss the interpretation of the Schmoo in Time. I read it with enormous interest, and it gave me some new light on the whole thing. It made me understand it a great deal better.
Amazing, Mr. Carter, I
just don't think that Al went into the Schmoo business quite so wide-eyed as all this. The Schmoo seems to have had a number of ideas, and one of them is one of, I think, Al's one of the things make him different than all other comic strip artists is that evil always triumphs in Little Abner, or almost always triumphs in all the other ones, in Little Orphan Annie and the Superman, good always comes up with a rush at the last minute. It's quite different in Dogpatch. In Dogpatch, everybody's getting along fine, and then some jay-roaring ham fatback gets in there, and everybody gets dumped on their ear again. And this, I think, represents a point of view that he has been expounding for a number of years.
Mr. Cap?
I don't think, John, that I feel that evil always triumphs. For instance, the Dogpatch is represented
today.
Yes, but the thing goes on. The dog patches represent the huge mass of dumb, believing, inarticulate people who are constantly being booted around by the enormous and powerful forces. And the enormous and powerful people triumph again and again in specific instances over the masses in Dogpatch. However, one thing remains with this huge group of peasants, and that is an abiding faith that things will turn out to be all right the next time some big, enormous guy tries to take them, and he does. The faith remains with them. The good things, the profits, all go to the other side. But the faith remains with the Dogpatchers, and maybe that is their triumph.
Well, that's just what I don't like. You see, we all live in some kind of a dog patch, and we're all getting kicked around. And shall we really say always something later on, something will happen? I think it's a very bad and a very wrong message.
Well, isn't that a reflection of what always does happen anyway, though, Dr. Worth?
No, I don't think so. I think, don't think that for the rest of the world, for all it
You
time,
don't think
all
the big people always...
No, I don't think
win.
So. No, I...
Of course, I'm likely to agree with Mr. Kapp that faith is perhaps better than the money that... That the big people wind up with.
Well, wouldn't it be better if you have a faith in doing something than a faith in some animals which can reproduce instantly?
Well, would you care to comment on the comic books and Dr. Wortham's feeling about comic books, Mr. Kapp? You're a comic strip artist, but I presume that some of your work does come out in comic books, too.
Yes, I've read with a great deal of interest Dr. Wortham's attacks on the comic books I think that Dr. Wortham is right. Now, this I know will be a disappointment to many comic book publishers who are listening to me. I think he's right when he says there are bad comic books.
Thank you.
Yes, but I'm not finished.
Every little bit helps.
You've got to remember
like
that things go along.
Nothing ever finishes here.
it never finishes, and always the episode. It doesn't turn out well, Doctor. So.
Dr. Wortham makes a splendid case against all comic books by selecting two or three very bad examples and smearing them all with that brush. Now, I had my office collect... Dr. Wortham is a doctor of medicine, I understand. Now, I had my office collect these statistics for me. That in New York City alone, during the past 10 years, over 800 medical doctors have been charged with manslaughter. Now, this is a large percentage of medical doctors. As great a percentage in relation to doctors as bad comic books are in relation to all comic books. Now,
how many of them were inspired by comic books? You have to think of them.
I have to say thank you all the time.
but using Dr. Wortham's logic, the fact that so many doctors have been charged with manslaughter might make us suspect that all doctors could possibly be guilty of manslaughter. Now, this is the sort of thing, the sort of attack that goes on about comics. One or two were picked out. A guy named Goebbels did it a few years ago and made a pretty good thing out of smearing a whole group by picking out a few notoriously bad examples. And that seems to be the pitch against comics. You pick one or two bad ones, make an enormous stink about them, and parents tear Bugs Bunny and Mickey Mouse books out of the pathetic fingers of their screaming infants.
That's not exactly how it is. Now, we'll give you one number. The bad comic books, bad, worst, violent, crime comic books have increased the first 6 months of this year over the 10 preceding years by 6,000%. Now, that we have figured out. Now, when you speak of two or three, you're not right. And if you would ask your friends, let me say something about your friend. You know, I like you. But when I see you, I feel about you like grating about Faust. It hurts me in my heart so deep to see the company you keep. Why do you ally yourself with these blood hucksters who don't sell two or three comic books, but millions of them, and the majority of them are dealing with bloodiness, with cruelty, and with torture. And that has nothing to do with you. Why don't we stick to schmooze and discuss philosophy and discuss entertainment? But you make yourself the spokesman of a group which I definitely think is antisocial. Mr. McCaffrey, if I may quote over the radio, a distinguished literary critic, Mr. Sterling North, who made a special study of comic books, and he called the comic book publishers racketeers. Now, who am I to contradict Sterling North?
I did regularly at one time.
Yeah. I think he can be contradictory.
He used to make a partial living at it.
I think I'm very happy that Mr. Cap does associate with this company. I'm glad somebody's in there pitching, trying to... I don't know if he's trying to improve the level of comic books, but, I mean, if Cap wasn't there, I don't know who would be there, and there does seems to be no doubt that the comic book is here to stay. The figures I haven't got, but I do know that a man got up that nobody ever saw before in front of a bunch of magazine publishers, including the publisher of Life and of the Saturday Evening Post. And he said, well, you people, of course, with these small local magazines that you put out, I mean, Life with 27 million, and he said, last month I published 80 million of his comic books. The figures are fantastic, and I think rather than condemn them as into existence, nobody's going to do that with this action that was done out in Los Angeles. I think they should be improved.
Do you think
And I think they are susceptible to improvement.
Do you think they're honestly distributed? Do you know, that there are all kinds of little people in this country who want to make an honest living by selling good magazines, and they can't do them because they have to sell this product of these blood hucksters. They have to do it, otherwise they can't sell the other one.
What are the blood hucksters now?
Comic book publishers.
People who live on blood, a different kind of huckster, yeah.
Well,
I'm not going to defend those, Dr. Wertham. I don't think anybody
can. But you are defending them right now, because that's the majority of the comic book publishers. And that's what Mr. Kapp has defended.
You see,
people get
mixed up. Do you defend them?
The hucksters in the radio field, you couldn't get any blood.
There's a word I'd like to say for my friend, the blood huckster. I think the whole...
Maybe you say something about this distribution. Why is it that people are forced to sell, torture, and murder when they want to sell a decent magazine? I've seen that with my own eyes, and some of these little people have told me that. Why do you need a psychiatrist? Why don't the lawyers do that?
Now, wait a minute. What decent magazines carry these blood hucksters?
Yeah, name one decent magazine.
No. That's too difficult. I have already mentioned three.
No, look,
a very simple magazine. People who want to sell an ordinary magazine in many places
cannot
do that unless they, at the same time, sell comic books.
Yes, it's well known.
It's well known. It's a racket, isn't it?
It's well known that these blood hucksters station a huge gorilla armed with clubs and guns to hit on the head any magazine publisher who has asked for a copy of Good Housekeeping. You're not allowed to buy Good Housekeeping. I've seen the bloody
These people can't make a living unless they can sell their magazines. These are little people who have candy stores and newsstands. And I tell you a very serious thing. This is criminal, what I'm talking about. They want to sell ordinary magazines. That's the right.
Well,
and
then come
agents twice a week. Of course. I come from a little village in Maine for my vacation, and twice a week the agents go around and sell them all these awful comic books. And these people don't want them.
Well, what do you mean, Dr. Wertham, that twice a week agents come around and sell them?
Bring them, deliver them.
Well, the man says, I'll take 100 of these, doesn't he?
Yeah, but supposing he says no. Then you can't have the other magazine. Then you can't sell any.
Well, I don't know that. That seems a little unreasonable to me.
It is, but apparently it is so. I'm telling you a fact. I'm telling you the result of an investigation.
Apparently, a lot of them have been saying no on account of the sales of comic magazines have been dropping like mad within the last 2 or 3 months.
Oh, really?
Yes, they have indeed.
As a result
of these attacks on comics. Now, let me tell you what the comic book is. The vast majority of comic books are reprints of newspaper comic strips. And I say that...
That's not correct.
Well,
that's not correct. Look, I've read
well,
them.
Go on, Mr. Cap. You tell me what...
But, in my own naive way, I think it is correct. I'm not naive. Well, I'm just a silly boy, and I believe the...
How many of Little Abner, let's get this down to facts, how many of Little Abner is sold next to these things that are pure invention, pure comic books, and don't appear, so far as I know, anywhere, like the Tiger Lady or some of those...
I think the percentage of newspaper reprints are about 80% of the total output of comics. Now, let me tell you something about newspaper reprints. These newspaper reprints are comic strips that appear first in family newspapers. These are done by honest, decent citizens like Milton Caniff and myself and Chick Young, or at least Milton and Chick. Then they're censored by the heads of our syndicates, who are very suspicious and tough men. All right? They're censored by them. Then each one of our strips goes out to our newspapers. We appear in 500, 600, 700 newspapers. Each editor censors each strip that goes in. So that by the time, and each editor has a different idea of what's good for kids, by the time any one of the great comic strips actually appears in newspapers, it's been censored by about 700 very suspicious editors. These reprinted are the great bulk of comic books. These comprise
Mr. McCaffrey,
about...
I can't contain
just
myself.
Just a minute, Dr. Wortham.
Well, but anyway, you can
it isn't
take
so.
On in just
it
a
isn't
minute.
So.
Just a minute, Dr. Wortham.
These comic reprints are the vast majority of comic books. I cling to 80% on account of I'm so naive as to believe things that I know to be true. They are the cleanest, most thoroughly censored, and by the way, the cheapest in point of view of price, juvenile literature. Dr. Wortham, you may now explain.
Cheap not only in price, cheap altogether. Well, now, it just isn't so. Let me very briefly, Mr. McCarthy. There are comic strips that appear in newspapers, and they are censored by the newspapers. There are over 1,500 censors in newspapers and syndicates who censor them. Comic books, and a very large percentage of them, are not censored by anybody. They have never appeared in newspapers. They have no censor at all. We censor everything, radio and everything. But what goes to children in books for 10 cents, that is absolutely uncensored. And those are the ones that I object to. Now, they have nothing to do with you. All your strips are censored. But all the things that these publishers put out, Crime Does Not Pay and all these guns and all these, nobody censors them. You see, that is the important point, and that's what I would like very much to make clear.
Well,
unless we go back to the schmoo.
Nobody fights about the schmoo. This is more fun. I want to add this, that Dr. Wortham's campaign against comic books has been so successful that when juvenile delinquents are caught burning or gouging the eyes out of their playmates, and an investigation is made of them, and they find that the kid has read a comic book. Newspaper headlines appeared. Comic book addict. Burns,
oh, good. They used to listen to the radio, you know.
Yeah.
Now they read comic books.
I mean, men of goodwill and good intention like Dr. Wortham point these things out as the result of the comic book. The fact that this child also has lived in a slum area.
Do they put out eyes in slum areas? What kind of a remark is that? In the comic books, they teach you how to put out eyes. They show you. You take a hypodermic needle. This is what you do. They show you how you blind a policeman. Do they teach you that in slums? I never heard of that.
Well, I in books dealing with crime, and this is that very small percentage of non-newspaper reprints, things like that may happen. For instance, in Oliver Twist, Mr. Fagan gives children an excellent lesson on how to pick pockets.
Well, I think that we have covered comic books, and perhaps we've covered the schmoo. I am sorry that his fate is indecisive here, that we can't tell exactly what is happening, but at any rate, I know that time is up for you gentlemen and for the schmoo. But here is Bob Sherry to tell what lies ahead on The Author Meets the Critics.
Next week, The Author Meets the Critics returns to books, and our guest will be the subject of a feature article in this week's Life magazine, the famous novelist Lewis Bromfield. Lewis Bromfield's writings include such novels as The Green Bay Tree, The Rains Came, and Mrs. Partington. He's the winner of a Pulitzer Prize, writes a weekly syndicated newspaper column, a director of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, the holder of 2 honorary Doctor of Literature degrees, and a Chevalier of the French Legion of Honor. Lewis Bromfield is also the author of a new book entitled The Wild Country, and we look forward to his meeting his critics face-to-face next Sunday at this same time. And now back to John McCaffrey.
Before closing, I'd like to thank Al Capp for coming here today to discuss the schmoo, and to thank you, Dr. Frederick Wortham, and you, Mr. John Crosby, for joining us. This is John McCaffrey saying good afternoon for The Author Meets the Critics.
The Author Meets the Critics is produced by Martin Stone and directed by Lee Jones. This is Bob Sherry speaking. This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.